This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we're airing segments from two different talks given on Monday this week. In the second half of the program, Senator Mike Lee speaks about his proposed bill to reform mandatory minimum sentencing as part of a greater effort to improve the criminal justice system. But first, on Monday, Governor Gary Herbert spoke for about an hour to a room full of students and community members about a variety of issues. He spent some of his time touting some of the innovative accomplishments in Utah this past year and the importance of education and maintaining a balanced budget. Governor Herbert used the last half of his time to answer questions from students, and that's where we're picking up his talk. Here is Governor Herbert taking a question from student Tyler Kane.
I have a question for you, Governor. This is a query I've had for a long time, and please feel free to correct me at any point during the preface of this question. So I'd like to return to the earlier topic of education. And from my understanding, public education has a lot to do with property values and the subsequent property taxes that coincide with them. And that can have like a disproportionate impact on rural communities. And I was wondering how much the current attempt of states reclaiming federal land has to do with education, or if that's more to establish energy independence as a state.
Well, it's both. It's not just one versus the other. As most all of you probably know, the state of Utah is blessed with 70% of our land mass that's owned by the government. And most of that is the federal government Bureau of Land Management. We do have Forest Service land. We have Indian reservations. We have state government ownership of some small parcels of land. But that's ground that you cannot tax. And so if we could just put a minimum property tax on our public lands that's owned by the federal government, we'd probably be awash in money when it comes to education. We could put that and divert that all into education. Other things too. But we certainly have a lot more money. It's not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It just is. And we have the opportunity to try to optimize the use of the public lands with tourism and travel. We have the ability to have farming and ranching that goes on with the Tater Grazing Act and other opportunities. We have to have access to public lands to help our agricultural industry. We also have the ability to, in fact, under the multi-use concept that's in the BLM statute, which they tend to forget and shy away from, but under the multi-use statute, we also have the ability to go out and access our natural resources. And so a lot of energy capability we have here in the state of Utah, particularly out in the basin, the Uinta Basin area of Utah, down in Carbon, Emery counties, have been a good part of our healthy economy here in the state of Utah. But it takes you a lot longer, and time is money, and so consequently with the dropping in the prices of oil right now, there's not a lot of energy development taking place out in the basin. It's really hurting the economy out there. It takes us about 15 to 16 months to get a permit to drill a natural gas oil or oil well out in the basin. If you're in North Dakota, which is kind of all energy all the time, you find it takes you about 3 months. And so it's a lot easier to go there in the private land and get a permit and get energy than it is here on our public land. We also get, though, from the federal government what's called PILT payments, payments in lieu of taxes. I actually went back and met with the president here a couple of years ago because he hadn't put it in his budget. And as I was talking to him in the Oval Office about, I'm here representing the western United States and Utah, that's where a lot of your public lands are, Mr. President, and we need to have those PILT payments, payments in lieu of taxes, put into your budget. We eventually worked with the Office of Management Budget and got that done, but that impacts our county governments. A lot of their budgets come from these PILT payments because they don't get a property tax return. And PILT payments are like getting 10 cents on the dollar or less, so it helps a little bit. It's not the total offset. But again, it's Utah, I can tell you, is a public land state, and I believe it will always be a public land state. The arguments and debates we have on the public land tend to be about who is going to manage those public lands, and we in Utah believe that the states should have more input into that management style, and I think if we do that, we'd get a better outcome that we all would enjoy. I call it the optimum, the balanced resource approach, which is what we're trying to do here in Utah, and hopefully we can work with the federal government to get that optimal balance point.
Hey, Governor. President recently put a hit on Keystone,
And, you know, I think we should all be concerned about it locally. I don't see that Congressman Bishop is really in a dander about this. I've been wanting to see, you know, if we have a current Democratic administration, I'm seeing that this might continue. And, you know, I'm concerned about, you know, how we can change, what we can do about the situation on Keystone.
Well, it's been a long debate. It's been a long, long time for the president to finally make a decision. It's my concern is it's only he's only analyzed one side of the equation. That's the environmental side, and seems to be a bone being thrown to the environmental community. And I would say the extreme environmental community. I think we all need to be environmentalists. I say it this way: we ought to be all good stewards of the earth and make sure that we're taking good care of our home. And with the new technology we have, the ability for us, in fact, to access our natural resources, and that includes energy, and rational and reasonable ways and responsible ways are available in ways we've never had before. The Keystone Pipeline, designed to take oil from Canada and take it down to the Gulf for refining, that energy is going to be developed someplace. It ought to be developed in America, where we have better controls and better regulations and more environmentally sound methodology. If it doesn't happen here, it'll probably go to foreign lands, because Canada's certainly going to export their resources, because that's what the economy will demand. And it's going to happen. The question is whether it's going to happen more responsibly. Secondly, putting it in a pipe is a lot more environmentally safe than transporting it over land or drilling a mile and a half deep waters like we do offshore. We've seen what happened in the Gulf spill and the problems there. So if you have a leak in a pipe, it's a lot easier to find and curtail and fix. So from the standpoint of the environment, I think the pipe is probably a better way to transport oil than any other option that's out there. And everybody along the way has signed off on it. And on the Democrat side, a lot of Democrats liked it. The labor unions liked it. It created and will create a number of jobs and opportunities there. So it seemed to be the common sense thing to do. President Obama's not convinced. And unless we have a change in the White House, which obviously we're going to have here in about 14 months, the next president will have to probably take that up, because I think it'll be blocked by the current president.
Hi. This might be a controversial topic, but it is one that is very dear to me. The Utah's administrative code states that the advocacy or encouragement of the use of contraceptive methods or devices may not be taught in Utah public schools, but research statistics show that teens that receive comprehensive sex education are 50% less likely to become pregnant. Now, you have said that cutting off federal funds flowing through the state to Planned Parenthood, which is the main source of sex ed for young women here, won't affect educational programs for preventing pregnancy and STIs, but this fiscal year in Utah, Planned Parenthood received over $200,000 of government funding for those programs, and that is a lot of money. I guess my question is, how is it logical for the state of Utah to both teach abstinence and also defund Planned Parenthood, but not expect teenage pregnancy rates to increase? Shouldn't it be one or the other?
Well, it's an emotional issue. There's probably nothing that's divided this country. In my lifetime, the Vietnam War and Roe versus Wade, abortion. And it's still divisive, and people on all sides continue to argue. People have tried to link it with that issue. That's not been the issue for the state of Utah. The videos, which people can talk about, they've been edited, they certainly have, but the content by independent review has said that there is a callousness there when it came to what we're going to do with the fetal body parts and use them for research. And even Planned Parenthood on the national level has apologized for that and said they're going to change their ways. We have about 5 different investigations going on in Washington, D.C., and so until those investigations are completed, I think the prudent course of action for us as a state to take was, in fact, because of your parent organization in violation of the law, possibly, we're going to, in fact, take the $200,000 that we've been giving to Planned Parenthood exclusively and redistribute the money, redirect it to other organizations to provide the same kind of services. We have 41 other organizations out there. rather than the seven Planned Parenthood organizations. This actually will help expand the operation and the availability of, in fact, women's health issues throughout the state. We have 29 local health departments now in all of our 29 counties, and to give them the money to provide the same kinds of services seems to be a wise thing to do. The second thing is Planned Parenthood has said, we are not going to change any of the business practices that we're doing. So whatever services they're providing will continue to be provided. They have an $8 million budget in Utah, which is a lot of money, compared to the $200,000 they get of state pass-through money. And so the ability, and I think it's wise on their part, say we will absorb that loss of federal monies passed through the state of Utah and continue to provide the services. So what has happened? We've expanded the services for women and their health care needs throughout the state in more venues that accommodate at least access in a better way. Once the investigations are done with what happens in Washington, D.C., and so we know what the truth is, we can reevaluate the situation and see if there's not a better way to do things.
I'm a Utah Navajo from San Juan County, and I know Bears Ears is a semi-controversial plan right now, but I was wondering if you are willing to work with the original families of the reservations, because I know we don't support, majority of us don't support the current plan as is, and I was just wondering if you'd be willing to.
Thank you. What do you think the current plan is?
I know the current plan is like Bears Ears and then the vast lands that I know majority of the families don't support that part.
Well, let me explain it this way. One, I have a great appreciation for our Native American brothers and sisters. And I have a foster brother who's a full-blooded Navajo. His name is Emerson Jimmy. And maybe because of my growing up with him, I have an appreciation that's maybe deeper than some. I recognize the history. And when I came in as lieutenant governor, 10 years ago, I created what's called the Native American Summit, designed to bring all of our eight recognized tribes of Utah together with government leaders of Utah and say, can we not have better communication and better understanding so we can develop better policy together? We had the uniqueness in this country of having sovereign nations inside sovereign states inside a sovereign nation. And the government complexity of that makes it somewhat difficult. I just met here last week with the chairman of the Ute Mountain Ute tribe talking about the Bears Ears issue and what we can do to find agreement and resolution. I do support Congressman Rob Bishop's public land initiative, which is designed to resolve about 18 million acres of controversy, which we've been fighting over for way too long on the public lands issue. And that includes the Bears Ears area. The question is whether the Bears area has to be a specific defined area only. Can it be modified and can it be set aside without use of a national monument? We still are smarting here in the state of Utah because of Bill Clinton and telling us he wasn't going to declare a national monument up until the day he did. He lied to our congressional delegation, including the Democrat, Bill Orton, at the time, who was in the delegation. And so that was really a disappointing action by the executive branch in a state that had no input. I've worked with the Secretary of Interior, formerly Ken Salazar, now Sally Jewell. They've said they won't do that to us again. And they will certainly work to get input from the local community, which is I support. It's about the process. I think there's an ability for us to set aside and take out of any development capabilities certain parts of Utah's public lands, the beautiful vistas and venues, maybe the Bears Ears or something similar to that. And the public land initiative that Congressman Bishop is proposing would, in fact, do that. And we don't have to have a national monument to protect pristine areas that deserve protection. So I think we can come together. We're working closely with our Native American friends to see if we can, in fact, have that incorporated into an overall master plan we call the Public Land Initiative, sponsored by Congressman Rob Bishop and Congressman Jason Chaffetz. And I think it's high time that we come together on that resolution and get something done that not only just takes care of 1.8 million acres of the Bears Ears area, but 18 million acres of really all of eastern Utah down to the southern part. And I have hopes for that to be done legislatively.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW and a talk by Governor Gary Herbert recorded Monday. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us today, we're airing talks by Utah Governor Gary Herbert and later in the second half of the program, Senator Mike Lee. Again, the governor spoke Monday this week and fielded questions from University of Utah students.
Yes, sir.
Governor, thank you for taking my question. I have a quick topic or a question about Syrian refugees, if that's all right. I know that earlier this month you stood alone as the only Republican governor in the nation to not refuse Syrian refugees. But from what I understand, you recently came out and said you'd support a federal plan to limit the intake of Syrian refugees. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the rationale behind that decision.
Yeah, I, again, being the methodical person that I am, I did not like the knee-jerk reaction that I heard, some coming because of folks running for president. Probably some political motivation there. I think the public is concerned. You know, we've lived through September 11th, and now we see this attack in Paris, and we feel vulnerable. What I wish the president had done was when this happened, was say, you know what, I understand the fear and anxiety of the American public. I understand the concerns that are being raised, and I will take it upon myself to make sure that we review the refugee program. We'll work with the states that have no ability to say yay or nay on refugees, but I want to calm their jitters and their fears by making sure that we have openness and transparency here. I've just have said we need to review the process. We've never said, I've not said yet, that we would not take refugees. Those who are oppressed, the refugee system is a symptom of the problem. The problem is ISIS and the terrorists out there. Why don't we, in fact, have more of an aggressive approach on stopping terrorism and fighting the root cause as opposed to taking out on those who are fleeing? Now, in response to letters that the governors have written, including myself, in response to a conference call that had Democrats as concerned about this as Republicans, in fact, maybe more pointed on the conference call we had with the president, saying this is not just about the Paris attacks. This is about a lack of communication from your administration to us states where we have people in our borders we don't even know about. Let's review the process. Let's have a better relationship. And that's what we're calling for. It's not a matter of banning refugees that need asylum and help. It's a matter of making sure that we don't have terrorists coming into our country. And it's not just the refugee program. It's certainly not just Syria. Jihadi John was a Brit. He was a British national. We have the headquarters of ISIS in Iraq. Afghanistan certainly has been a headquarters for terror. But it's all portals into the country. And it's not just refugee programs. It's tourists. It's people that come here on education visas. It's people who slip over the borders as immigration, legal or illegal. All of those need to be reviewed if we're going to make sure that we protect the safety and well-being of the American public. So all we're calling upon, all I've called upon, is let's review the system. I'm calling upon our state officials, which we're in the process. I'll probably have recommendations here this week as far as what can we do to make sure that when people come into our state that they are not here to do us harm. And maybe that's oversight of the federal regulations, making sure that we review the refugee program ourselves and have some redundancy in the system, checking our immigration situation, working with ICE. I mean, all those factors come to mind. We're not going to change what we're doing. We're not going to cower in fear because of the terrorists. But we certainly have a responsibility to be prudent and look through the process and see if there's some ways we can improve it to make sure that we are all kept safe.
Governor, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. My question is about air quality. And this is a problem that impacts public health, it impacts economic development, and so therefore the need to improve air quality year-round. Last year, the legislature had 17 bills, addressed two minor issues, but the major bills were not passed by the legislature.
Well, part of it is the sense of urgency happens when we have gunky air, and last year we had good air during the inversion periods of time, and it wasn't as acute. Let me just mention a couple of facts. The air is better today than it was 10 years ago. If you were to graph it and just look at the science, you'll find that we've done a lot of remarkably good things to clean up the air. We have unique topography, and so even though we pollute less per capita than most big city areas of the nation, when you put that lid on the added inversion, even though you're polluting less, it certainly builds up and the concentration levels get unacceptable. We have about, on average, 18 days of bad air. We have people say we're as bad as L.A. I don't know why L.A. is always the benchmark for bad air, but we do have days when it approaches an L.A. bad air day. But L.A. has 255 bad air days compared to our 18. So there is some, reason to compare, but some of that would be a distortion. We had one of the environmental groups that put out a publication talking about the air sheds over our public parks and said that it is as bad as 70s L.A. air, which was just such a lie. It's not true. We, in fact, have been recognized by the pristine air and the pristine views that come because of our good air over our national parks and our rural parts of Utah. I understand people's, inclination to hyperbolate and exaggerate, what's taking place when it comes to air quality. But it doesn't help us because we've got to know what the truth is and what the science is so that we can direct the problem and solve the problem. Our industry people here on the Wasatch Front are spending hundreds of millions of dollars in what's called best available technology to, in fact, find ways to improve their refining processes, their industry, their manufacturing, and it's working significantly well. The part right now that where most of the air quality problems come from is at the tailpipes of automobiles and trucks. And so we've called upon our refineries and our automobile dealers to move in a hurry to Tier 3 fuels and Tier 3 automobiles. That'll do the best thing we can do to, in fact, improve the air quality here along the Wasatch Front. And they've all responded positively. I think we will beat the federal mandated deadline and hopefully get that done over the next couple of years, which will be a dramatic improvement. Because over 50% now of the air quality problem is out of tailpipes. It's not industry. Industry is about 20%. And they've done a lot. You know so much we can get out of them, but we out of the rest of us, we can get some more. Another 25% comes out of our homes and our businesses here in the local community. We found from a University of Utah study that a significant disproportionate amount comes from wood-burning stoves. And we put together a proposal to have those who have to burn wood as their sole source of heat to put money aside to help them transition to more fuel-efficient, like natural gas, fireplaces and stoves, EPA-approved wood-burning stoves, so they can transition from just burning wood that pollutes. And unfortunately, the public in mass said, we don't want the government telling us how we can burn in our fireplaces and our stoves. And so our air quality division heard the cry of the public. The environmental community was puzzlingly silent about this issue, by the way. And so we still have burn capability of wood, which is probably not healthy for our air quality. Nobody wants to take away from emergency situations and those kind of needs, and we put money aside to help people transition. So there's some things we can do better. But the good news is, one, our air is better this year than it was 10 years ago. It'll be better in the next 10 years. The trajectory is very good. We're polluting much less, and we pollute much less as a population than virtually any place in America, but we have meteorology that makes it a little difficult. We have some gunky air days, but we are working together with all sources and all people to make sure that we continue to improve the air quality.
And that was Utah Governor Gary Herbert speaking Monday this week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. You can find a link to the governor's full talk online on kcpw.org. Coming up next, Senator Mike Lee speaks about his proposed bill that aims to improve the criminal justice system. The senator has been working with other lawmakers to change laws that require mandatory minimum sentencing for people convicted of drug crimes. Senator Lee says these so-called tough-on-crime laws are excessive and have overwhelmed prison populations and cost millions of dollars that would be better spent rehabilitating prisoners and targeting violent criminals. A link to Senator Mike Lee's full talk can be found on kcpw.org. We're picking up his talk halfway.
This effort has been successful in large part because of the fact that this is an idea whose time has come. For a long time, including and up through the mid-1980s and up until very recently, there has been an instinct on the part of politicians generally, and by politicians I mean Republicans and Democrats alike, to want to be known as being tough on crime. Now, that is still the case. I don't know one elected official, I don't know any member of Congress, who wants to be known as being soft on crime. And everybody wants to be hard on crime. But what we've tried to get across in this effort is that in addition to being hard on crime, or in other words, as part of being tough on crime, we have to be smart in the way we punish crime. Because as I mentioned a few minutes ago, every dollar that we spend on incarcerating someone is a dollar that we can't spend somewhere else, a dollar that we might be able to spend better on some other effort that involves protecting the American people from criminal activity. And as more and more of the money that we set aside for the Department of Justice goes to our federal prison system, we will eventually find that we don't have enough money to do the things that we need to do in order to enforce our criminal laws at the federal level. And so that's been one of the big challenges that we've faced, is that until members read the legislation and become familiar with what it does, and just as importantly, what it doesn't do, there are some who are instinctively, reflexively, so wedded to this notion that they want to be tough on crime that they want to oppose it. I have a few responses to that. One is that if they read the bill, they'll see that this isn't a one-way ratchet. It's not a one-way lever. It actually creates some new minimum mandatory sentences. It creates, for example, a new minimum mandatory sentence for an act of violence in interstate commerce that results in death. And it also creates a new minimum mandatory sentence for somebody involved in exporting arms to terrorist organizations. And so it is not a one-way ratchet. Nor is it the case that this in any way weakens our ability to keep Americans safe. In fact, for the reasons I've explained, I actually think it strengthens our ability to enforce our criminal laws effectively and efficiently. And I think it also has a certain tendency to help prepare those who are already in prison to return to civilian, non-prison life and to behave as responsible citizens. The more we can do that, the better off we will be. I found more or less that most lawmakers, once they read the legislation, once they become aware of it, will be supportive of it. And we've got a great coalition of people behind it. And some are conservative Republicans, some are liberal Democrats, a lot of them are somewhere in between. This is one of these issues that is not distinctively Republican or Democratic. It's neither liberal nor conservative. It's simply an American issue. I would add to that, that speaking for myself as a conservative, I think it is especially important to undertake this activity. Sometimes I get the question, how can you be a conservative and yet want to pass this bill? My response to them, in addition to the other points that I've made, often focuses on the fact that nowhere, whether you're a conservative or not, nowhere is it more important to make sure that we rein in government power than in the area of criminal justice. Because within our criminal justice system, where we incarcerate people, where we deprive them of due process in a way that we don't deprive them in any other area of our law, it's especially important. And therefore, it ought to be important, not just to lawmakers generally, but especially to conservatives. And so, anyway, this has been a great effort, and I'm very proud to have been a part of it. With that, why don't we open up the floor to questions and we can talk about what's on your mind and answer any questions you may have.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. We're now airing a segment of a talk given by Senator Mike Lee on Monday this week. Senator Lee spoke about his efforts to reform mandatory minimum sentencing laws for people convicted of drug crimes. After his talk, Senator Lee answered questions from students.
Tell me where you're from and what you're studying.
Hi, Senator. Thanks for coming. My name is Chris Coombs, and I am currently a double major in political science and history. My question is, you mentioned that politicians in general, Republicans and Democrats alike, do not want to be perceived as being weak on crime. Recently, President Obama, through executive action, released a handful of prisoners through federal prison, if I'm not mistaken. Is that reconcilable at all to the previous statement? Is President Obama being weak on crime, or is he being smart on crime?
You know, that's a good question. I haven't had a chance to review each of those. Yep, I know there was a significant group of them that he had released pursuant to a change in policy made by the Federal Sentencing Commission. And when the U.S. Sentencing Commission made those changes, he decided to put those into effect with respect to some people who had already been incarcerated. That does deal with a different set of offenders than what we're talking about here. It's certainly not inconsistent with what we're trying to do through the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, nor does it obviate the need to pass the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act.
My name is Sean Folsom, studying political science and finance from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. My question has to deal with the recidivism rate that you talked about before. What, I guess, I hear there's, you know, workforce programs to help prisoners, you know, have some type of transferable skill when they get out. But I hear those don't work, and a lot of them don't get hired because of their, you know, previous conviction. So what new things can we teach them, you know, new transferable skills, so when they do come out, they can actually have a job? So anything new, anything you're thinking about?
Yeah. Part of this is going to be a work in progress. This is going to evolve as we figure out what works and what doesn't. There are some job skills that can be taught in prison, also interview skills and things like that, in addition to treatment that they can receive, counseling on factors that might have contributed to the criminal acts that they decided to engage in. And so there's a pretty broad panoply of things that we can look at, things that we can teach people that can help them make the transition. That is not to say that it will be made easy because of the problem that you described. People who have been in prison do often find a lot of hardship in trying to find a job. Fortunately, there are some employers out there, and this appears to be a growing trend, that are not only willing, but in many cases eager to hire people who have struggled, to hire people who have been convicted of a particular offense, and to see what opportunities they can offer them. Recently met a restaurant operator, I'm trying to remember what state he was from. One of my colleagues in the Senate introduced me to him. He runs a restaurant. I can't remember which colleague it was now or from which state they came. Anyway, they run this great restaurant, and the owner of the restaurant is himself a convicted felon, one who got out of prison, decided he wanted to get his life turned around, and decided that he wanted to create opportunities for other people to do that. Now they have this very big, successful restaurant with a catering business, and the people who work for them are convicted felons. And so far, in the last few years, they've had a 100% success rate with those whom they've hired. I know there are employers around our state and throughout the country who are making similar decisions, and they've had some pretty good success with that, and I'm encouraged by that.
Good afternoon, Senator. I'm Allison Stapleton, Economics and Political Science. Is there any part...
A lot of overachievers in this room.
Right? Yeah. Short majors, add more. Are there any plans to bolster community programs for drug rehabilitation or mental illness, either through the prison system itself or through the community?
There are programs like that in existence already. They're constantly being reevaluated and reformed. Those are not part of this particular effort, but yeah, we do have programs that deal, federal programs that deal with both of those, in addition to federal grants that we provide to state and local law enforcement entities that in turn provide similar programming.
Yep. Hey, Senator, my name's Max.
Good to see you.
I understand that your legislation would reduce the sentencing for many of them to, you know, not be so ridiculously long, but does it also just eliminate sentencing at all for many of these frivolous examples that you've talked about? Are there just less people ending up in jail, not just for a shorter time, but period?
Okay, good question, Max. The short answer to your question is no. This bill doesn't eliminate anything that is currently criminal and punishable as a crime under federal law is not rendered non-criminal and non-punishable by this particular proposal. There are many that feel that something should be decriminalized, and there will be efforts along that front. There are efforts that have been introduced along those lines that I support. For example, I'm a co-sponsor of a bill recently introduced by Senator Hatch that I hope and expect will end up getting some bipartisan support that deals with criminal offenses for which there is no mens rea element. Now, I promise not to use Latin legal speak without explaining what that means. The mens rea is the element of a criminal offense that describes the level of intent required to undertake that offense. The most silly criminal laws on the books are those that lack a mens rea offense. And it's disturbing that there are as many of those on the books as there are. There are myriad ways that you can commit federal offenses without even being aware that of the fact that you're committing a federal offense or even having any intent to commit the crime in question. A lot of those are what we call regulatory criminal offenses. For example, I wrote a book that came out earlier this year called Our Lost Constitution. In part of that book, I describe the plight of a father and son in Florida who purchased some property in Florida and got all the appropriate permits. They and ended up building a house on that property and then selling the house. Even though they had gotten all the appropriate permits, unbeknownst to them, the EPA considered that property to be a wetland, even though it didn't have any of the hallmark characteristics of a wetland, even though it hadn't been identified as a wetland anywhere. Because they built the house on it, they were convicted of a federal environmental regulatory crime in the absence of any intent to violate federal law. And in fact, they had undertaken a fair amount of due diligence to make sure they were complying with the law. As it turns out, there are a number of instances in the law where that kind of thing happens, where you can commit an accidental felony. And this is one of those efforts to do that, to change some of those. But the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act does not do that. We made a calculated decision at the outset of the project to keep it relatively narrowly focused because we wanted to get as big of a bipartisan coalition behind it as possible. And while there are a lot of feelings in both political parties about over-criminalization generally, we knew that it would be more difficult to develop that coalition if we broadened it out further to talk about what you're talking about, which is decriminalizing certain things.
Senator, thank you for speaking to us today. My question pertains to the federal facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. How would your bill that you're co-sponsoring impact the prisoners that are held there, some of them for over 13 years that have not had their full habeas corpus rights? Would you favor, as part of the bill, to have that facility closed and have the prisoners, about 100 now of what had been about 1,200, relocated to facilities within the United States, or even to have them released to other foreign countries?
Okay. The short answer to your question is no, this bill doesn't do anything about Guantanamo Bay. Because this deals with our federal criminal justice system, and the people who are housed at Guantanamo as prisoners are not part of the federal criminal justice system. They're being detained in a military brig as enemy combatants, and so they're part of a different system. This bill doesn't deal with that system. With respect to the part of your question that is addressing how I feel about that, I have grave reservations with the idea of closing Guantanamo Bay without knowing what we're going to do with the people who are there. We've got to know where they're going. I also have, I'm very opposed to bringing them into the United States. That changes their legal status in many respects. Now, if somebody has a proposal for something else they would want to do with those who are currently incarcerated at Guantanamo Bay, I'm always open to consider that. But I am categorically opposed to just closing it and saying, we're going to take them to the United States, put them inside the federal prison system. They're there for very different reasons, for reasons that have nothing to do with the federal criminal justice system.
Thank you, Senator, for coming. My name is Austin Fulton. I'm from West Jordan, and I am a student here at the U studying political science and business. My question for you is really that it's encouraging to know that there is so much bipartisan support for criminal justice reform. Within Congress, have you noticed any other bills or efforts in other subjects or other topics that are gaining similar support? I know that's something that has been somewhat of an issue, finding that it's a rare moment to find that kind of bipartisan support nowadays.
Yeah, thank you for your question. I'm happy to talk about that. It's interesting. Bipartisanship is actually a lot more common than many of you might think, in part because frequently what's portrayed in the media, the issues that are described in the media, are often those as to which the parties are pretty consistently opposed to each other, where there's a pretty clear ideological difference. Those areas do exist, but there are lots of other areas where they don't exist, where support lines are not drawn on a rigidly partisan basis. Let me just give you a few examples of some of the bipartisan efforts that I've been a part of that are moving forward or have moved forward to one degree or another. I've been working for a long time on a patent litigation reform effort, trying to overhaul our patent litigation system. There has been a problem with what they call patent trolls, those who claim an ownership in a particular patent, who will engage in sort of unethical litigation practices. For example, let's suppose that you own a coffee shop just off of campus. And what's your name again? Is it Austin?
Yes.
Austin's Coffee Shop. And like any good coffee shop, you want to offer free Wi-Fi to your patrons, to your customers, so you do that. Let's suppose you get a letter one day in the mail from some lawyer in another state, maybe somebody in Texas, saying, "Dear Austin, I own the patent to this particular system. I own a patent that governs how Wi-Fi is provided to people. And the Wi-Fi router that you're using is in violation of that. You are a user of that. You're therefore liable. We're going to initiate litigation proceedings against you. Send us a check for $5,000 and this will all go away. Otherwise, go hire a lawyer." Now, you know it's going to cost you $5,000 or more just to retain a lawyer, just to figure that out. So a lot of people in that position just write out a check, even though they know that there's no legitimate patent claim against them. Anyway, I'm part of a bipartisan effort on that one. I teamed up with my friend Pat Leahy. Pat Leahy is a liberal Democrat from Vermont, but he and I are good friends. He frequently refers to us as the odd couple. I joked with him a few weeks ago that there have been times when my wife has complained, you talk to Pat Leahy more than you talk to me. He and I agree on a number of issues. Patent litigation reform is one of them. That's another bill that has moved out of the Senate Judiciary Committee with a strong bipartisan support base, and that I hope will reach the floor sometime in the next few months. Pat Leahy and I were involved in another effort a few months ago that I'm very proud of, called the USA Freedom Act. Pat Leahy and I both are former prosecutors who are very concerned about making sure that the American people have their Fourth Amendment interests protected, meaning that they're not subject to unreasonable searches and seizures, and that the government shouldn't have access to records that are yours and that reveal all kinds of personal information about you. The federal government has, for a number of years, undertaken a practice pursuant to Section 215 of the Patriot Act, whereby if you have a telephone, as I'm sure all of you do, the federal government collects data on calls that you make to other people, calls that other people make to you, when you talked, and how long you spoke. They put all that data into a database, some of which is stored in Utah, and they keep it for 5 years at a time in a searchable database. Now, they get that information through a kind of an interesting process. They get an order from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court that just says, for example, dear Verizon, send us all your records for this month or for last month or whatever they want. Send us all of it. They don't have to make any showing that the data they're requesting is connected to some act of terrorism that they're investigating. They just say, send us your records. This, I believe, and Pat Leahy believes, ends up feeling and behaving in many respects like a general warrant. General warrants were in use in England, in pre-revolutionary era England, where they would get a warrant issued by a court basically saying, a crime was committed, go find the people who committed the crime, search whoever you think might have been involved. Then they can go and search your house or anyone else's house. It was against that backdrop that the Founding Fathers put in place the Fourth Amendment, which contains a particularity requirement, saying that the government can't just go out and collect information because it wants to pursuant to a warrant. They have to identify with particularity the persons and the places to be searched, and they have to have evidence about the relevance of those persons or places to an actual investigation, and they have to have evidence supporting probable cause that a crime is involved. So anyway, Pat Leahy and I were bothered by the fact that this was going on, because as it turns out, they can find a lot of information out about you just by that calling data. Defenders of this program have been inclined to say things like the following. Well, we're not actually recording your phone calls through this. We're not collecting any content of the calls, just the fact that they were made, how long they lasted, and with whom who the parties to the call were. That's all fine until you realize that when you have 5 years' worth of data of that sort, a group of graduate research students at Stanford a few years ago did an experiment with a select group of people, and they were able to determine just by looking at the telephone metadata with those people, they were able to ascertain the sex, the age, the educational attainment level, marital status, political affiliation, religious affiliation, health condition of the people involved. They could also tell what prescription drugs you were likely taking. They could tell all kinds of things about you just by analyzing your calling patterns. This is especially dangerous because all of this can be automated. In some ways, the fact that it can be automated makes it almost more dangerous than if they were, I don't want to overstate the point, but they can do things with automation through telephone metadata that they couldn't do if they were monitoring everybody's calls, because there's only so much they can put into the effort to listening to phone calls. But with this, they can data mine. They can query anything they want. Now, they don't, they insist that they don't. I can't point to a single instance in which I know that the bulk data collection program within the NSA has been abused. But I do know this. The nature of human beings is such that sooner or later, that program will be abused if we leave it intact. There was a committee put in place in the Senate about 40 years ago called the Church Commission, which reviewed things that had happened within the federal government over a period of many decades. They concluded, among other things, that in every presidential administration from FDR through Nixon, our intelligence gathering apparatus within the federal government had been used to engage in political espionage. And so the concern is that if we leave this telephone metadata collection program in place, eventually it will be abused. Anyway, Pat Leahy and I got together on that one, and we wrote the USA Freedom Act, which would get rid of the bulk telephone metadata program. That passed into law in June, and there's a phase-in period, which is about to kick in. So within a matter of days, the telephone metadata program will no longer exist. Now, this was a huge lift. A lot of people said it couldn't be done. I had a lot of opposition, especially at the outset, from my own party. Democrats were far more supportive of this than Republicans were, especially at the outset. But eventually, we got it passed by pretty broad bipartisan numbers, and the president signed it into law.
And that was Senator Mike Lee speaking to University of Utah students on Monday this week. Well, we're wrapping things up here, but if you're interested, you can find links to both Governor Herbert's talk and Senator Mike Lee's talk on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your humble curator and host. Thanks for listening.